In your book, you talk about, you're calling them first globals, this generation.
Yes.
And what is that generation?
Other folks call them the millennials, those born between 1979 and so far 1993. We only capture them when they're 18. But essentially, I call them America's first global citizens because there is so much about them that have a planetary sensibility really not seen anywhere close among any of the other age cohorts.
I'm a part of this generation, so tell me about us. What else?
Well, 61% of your entire age cohort has active passports. 70% have been abroad. 44% of you tell us that you expect, not hope or wish, but expect to live and work in a foreign capital. Your friends have changed. Previous age cohorts talk about friends on the personal, social, intimate basis. You folks have a network, and your network knows no space nor geography. So much of your lives is horizontal and borderless. You are the age cohort that's least likely to think that American culture is superior to the cultures of other peoples in other places. And with all of this comes huge changes in the workplace, in philanthropy, in the world of non-governmental organizations, in housing, in family life, in so much of how we have conducted our lives in business.
What effects could this have on America, if young people are planning to leave the country to work elsewhere, young people are not having perhaps the same view of American exceptionalism as previous generations?
There's two pieces to that. No, there is a different sense of American exceptionalism, but let's talk about that notion of quote-unquote leave the country, because what we're finding is that home has a completely new definition. And this is what I tell, in particular, local economic development officials. Home, and I'm sorry to dredge up the old cliche, but home is where your heart is. And so you may be doing a gig in Switzerland, or you may be doing a gig in Anchorage, but that doesn't mean that you're not home, or that you're not paying taxes, or that you're not in some way, shape, or form emotionally tied to home. Now, that's on a community level. This age cohort is as likely to say that it's a citizen of the planet Earth as it is to say that they are citizens of the United States of America. But nonetheless, there is an attachment that is here, an attachment that is such that it in many ways redefines how they see the role of the United States and the rest of the world. These are the waning days, emotionally as well as politically and economically, of the American empire. Now, that is not a left-wing or ideological stance on my part. It's simply looking at the numbers. And when I look at the numbers and I see all the other age cohorts, those in their late 30s all the way up to old age versus this age cohort, which is essentially 18 to about 32 years of age, just an incredible differential, a sensibility that United States does not control, should not control. In order to lead, it must be a player among many regional powers. That decision making is no longer a superpower, or for that matter, a United Nations that's a conglomeration of superpowers. But that decision making and policy will come less in a vertical structure. Oh, we've got a problem. Let's move it up the line. I think you're beginning to see the end of that sort of thing take place in Penn State, as a prime example, as I'm here and as we speak. Young people see a problem and they go horizontal with it and say, let me send this out to my network and let's see who's 1, 2, or 3 degrees away from helping us to get together and solve the problem rather than moving up and down a chain.
Do you think that this is at all a reaction to the previous generation, people in my generation reacting to what our parents or perhaps the boomer generation had done? I don't think that the boomer generation necessarily holds the greatest place in the heart of a lot of young people today, given a lot of what had happened culturally, say, in the 1980s or later. And I think politically there seems to be, this is my observation, a frustration. Someone I know in the boomer generation had said during the 2008 election that they were going to support Barack Obama in the Democratic primary because, to quote her, "I'm sick of my generation. I'm sick of the same battles that were fought in the 1960s being fought today." And that seems to be a view that at least I see with a lot of my peers, is we're tired of this previous battle.
You know,
or I guess
that's it's a complicated question. I like complicated questions. First of all, you're talking to an aging boomer, and I call ourselves in my book Woodstockers. We are a group that were defined as we were born, right on up to our old age, as self-indulgent. Hence, Woodstock was really the ultimate example, characterization of that self-indulgence. Nonetheless, what I find very interesting is that if there's any one age cohort that more closely but not quite entirely approximates the values of this generation of globals, it's us, your parents. And sure, there are differences between parents and children. By the same token, we have funded an awful lot of this globalism. And as we talk more and more about young kids that have studied abroad, we know who paid the bills for that. But honestly, with that said, one of the things that you're not hearing that you did hear when I was 19, reflecting upon the greatest or the World War II generation, our parents, is that there's no generation gap here. That young people may be puzzled over our lack of facility with technology, or some of our views are tribute to the greatness of America and its values. But when push comes to shove, there's not a resentment that's here. And so these are two age cohorts that really fundamentally get along with each other.
Do you think, though, that with young people, no matter how emotionally connected they are to America or even financially connected if they're paying taxes, intellectually it would seem that if they're planning to leave and work elsewhere, that is fleeing the ship in some way. That's leaving behind a structure that has, at least now for people entering the job market, and I know a few years ago with myself entering the job market, it was dismal. And there was a feeling that there was nothing left essentially to offer to me or to people my age.
Since I wrote this book, there's been a dramatic turn in the immediate outlook of young people. And the more that this crisis drags on, the more there's a sense of resentment, but more so anxiety and fear. What was once an open market and just an open field is closed more and more. And as it drags on, there's a sense of almost hopelessness. When is the corner going to be turned? But even as I say that, I don't think that we ought to link the sense that the whole world is my playing field with abandonment from where I am. This is still a place, the United States, my community, that grows and nurtures me and is somehow bonded internally within me, and I'm speaking for young people. And so even though I'm a citizen of the planet Earth, I am not then abandoning the ship. I'm going where there is opportunity, but my heart remains wherever it is that I've bonded.
But the heart doesn't necessarily make you a world power anymore.
In terms of the United States, well, I think that there is so much going on economically, politically, militarily, financially, that also weighs against that. This is just one more element of an entire superstructure of institutions and outlooks and attitudes that suggests the waning of a great power. Still a great power, nonetheless, but a great power on a big planet.
You say that you don't see right now a frustration or a bitterness from between the two generations, the Woodstockers, as you call them in the first Globals. Do you think there is room for that frustration to grow looking at something like, for example, Occupy Wall Street, where if you look at it in some ways, you could see a generational difference between the people in Zuccotti Park or the people in whatever park anywhere, essentially, or protesting against the group of people their parents' age who had brought globalization, who had brought these new markets that are now letting down the younger generation?
The honest answer is yes, there is a potential for that. And one of the more significant reasons why this has to be resolved before it does fester and it becomes a widespread intergenerational bitterness. In other words, I'm having a hard time getting a job that pays taxes, a hard time getting a job that looks out for my retirement, and here I am, then I am going to be funding people who essentially are living much longer. Social Security was a wonderful thing when we all had the good sense to die at the age of 68, you know, and only collect 3 or 4 years of it. Now, we Woodstockers can see 25, 30, 35 more years of healthy living available to us, and we're not about to retire, or for that matter, to give up on some of those things that we've earned and attained. This is a much larger and much layered crisis in that sense. And if we don't come to a plan for resolution over the next couple of decades for this, yeah, to be sure, when young people, when the job market does straighten out, they're going to be walking into a situation where a larger chunk is taken out of their pay in order to subsidize a generation that wouldn't let go. We don't want to see that happen, though.
I will toss in here that my parents are Woodstockers, and I appreciate all they've done. But how much in the trends that you're seeing are actual changes in the world, and how much of it is just following this pattern of the next generation is different from the other? The next generation might be a little more socially progressive. The next generation rebels in their own way, wants to do something different.
There are two things that create an age cohort. You know, one is that there are certain patterns that define 20-somethings and make them different from 40 and 50 and 60-somethings. There is something about our position in the life cycle. And, you know, whether we have long-term relationships, steady employment, social status, educational achievement, those are the sorts of things that will always make an age, half of an age cohort. The other half that defines the age cohort is the historical period which they live and the defining moment within that historical period. You know, 20-somethings were 20-somethings who loved to dance and play and drink beer and do lots of things December 6th, 1941. And then, boom, December 7th, 1941, turned those kids into the greatest generation. You know, much the same way that the Cold War and the Soviet Union defined the next generation. Perhaps the Kennedy assassination through Watergate defined what I call the Nikes, but others would call Generation X. So there's a mix of that. Some of it is very predictable, but some of it also is the world in which we live. And despite coming of age after 9/11 and a world of terrorism, this group has come of age with handheld technology, the world at its fingertips, a sensibility that if Muslims are doing crazy things, just who are these Muslims? And could there be 1.5 billion crazy Muslims? I think I owe it to myself to try to find out just who these people are. So there's a greater appreciation. You actually hear young people say, how bad can these people be if they make such good music? And if they wear what I wear, or they wear it a little bit differently, but it looks so cool. And so it's, in that sense, it is much, much different.
But isn't that what has happened so many times before. I mean, you could say that, and I think you could find a number of musicologists and sociologists who would make the argument, say, for example, in the 1950s, if Chuck Berry is singing songs about trying to find girls in school and driving his car after class, and he's wearing, you know, the same sort of clothes, and he's living that same sort of life, that that was bridging a racial gap as well. That that's been happening, it seems, throughout the ages.
You look at all the world religions, and what amazes you are not the differences but the similarities in myths and legends and codes of ethics, behaviors and practices. Why? Because there were always travelers. There's always been trade for thousands of years. What we've done is we've speeded up that interconnectedness, and that's what the difference is. No, sure, you can look at global and cultural bridging down through the ages. To me, that's what makes history such a dynamic field. The more we learn, that's why we continue to dig, isn't it? And anytime you read a poet or dig up a fossil or look at an ancient sculpture, what you see is not simply the pinpoint placement of where it came, but the sum total of all the cultures that had been involved in making that. Things that many of us can't verbalize. Today, it's the immediacy of it all. So young people your age, the difference between you and us is that not necessarily smarter, although more of you are educated, but you may not be able to find Darfur on the map, but the difference is you know that there is a Darfur on the map. That's a global sensibility that defies really any other age cohort. My generation, many went off to Vietnam, but frankly, they didn't know where they were going.
To extrapolate this, and how far are you comfortable extrapolating the trend you're seeing, then, if things are speeding up, if there is some sort of Moore's Law of culture even, are we headed toward a sort of cultural singularity? Where there isn't, where the age differences are not as noticeable, where the geographical differences are not as noticeable, where there really wouldn't be a need to define one generation as first globals and other as Woodstockers. Are we headed toward that point?
Well, no. No. You're always going to have the other half of what defines an age cohort. So I think if when you start to see 20-somethings experiencing hardening of the arteries and loss of hearing, and hair loss and stuff like that, then let's start to worry about too much bridging taking place.
I'll jump in that I am 26 and losing my hair and ears aren't what they used
to
be
for
years and as of music listening and radio making.
There you go. Your point is well taken. No, it's a very intriguing question, but no, we are not becoming one person. No, there is so much about us, our physiognomy, our geography, you know, our parentage, how we earn a living, and so on, including our age cohorts. 20-somethings are always going to be 20-somethings. That's always going to be different from a 60-something. And I think one of the positive things about being 50-plus 60-something these days is that, as I write in the book, we Woodstockers are coming to grips for the first time with the fact that we need a second act and that we do have to, in many ways, start acting our age. You know, you can't be in your 60s and say, the high point of my life was when I was 20 and I ended a war. And so we see now that, first of all, Woodstockers are going to find it very difficult to retire anyway, financially. But also, we're the first age cohort that will have a million of us reach the age of 100. You know, and just saying that suggests thriving, healthy, mentally and physically people who have so much to add to the workforce and to training and so many aspects of our lives, there's a tremendous change right there.
Do you think that addresses part of the criticism that Christopher Buckley, I know a few other folks have made, in that the baby boomers didn't build anything? Their parents fought a war. Their parents built the highways. What did they build? They made certainly some social progress, but they didn't leave a giant monument. I can drive on an interstate system and know that my grandparents' generation did that, but what can I see physically? There isn't this physical monument.
I know Christopher Buckley enough to know that this time he's wrong. It all depends what the act of building is. We were in the civil rights movement. We were spearheading the women's rights movement, the gay rights movement. We helped push an end to the war in Vietnam. There's so much about us that was redefining as opposed to, you know, the art of architecture. So I'm very critical of mm-hmm. We Woodstockers, but I don't want to throw the baby boomer out with the boomer water.
Given that,
to extend the metaphor.
Given that a lot of these rights movements are still continuing in some form, new waves or even the same waves continuing with my generation, do you think it's too easy to overlook the contributions of the Woodstockers?
Oh, I do. Oh, no, absolutely. We helped mold and change a world and set the table very nicely, both metaphorically and really for our kids. We've helped to create this global citizenry.
Well, thanks for that, and thanks for your time.
Thank you.